minds to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-7024. Ali Mahmoud Ali Shafi is Midway and a medical guardian of plaintiff Ramia Ali Shafi et al. Versus Palestinian Authority, also known as Palestinian National Authority, also known as Palestinian Interim Self-Government Authority, and Palestinian Liberation Organization. Ms. Tolson for the appellant and Ferguson for the athlete.
Morning, Mr. Tolson.
Morning, Your Honor.
May I proceed? If I make one point today, probably I have a second, but what I want it to be is that we are not alleging a ATS claim for torture. We're alleging an ATS claim for war crimes, and the war crime is torture. And jurisprudentially, there's a huge difference. Nobody will question that torture carried out as part of an armed conflict is a violation of the Geneva Convention, Article 3, and is a war crime. It's a pretty heinous war crime. And the question that defense counsel seeks to raise based on the Emergi decision that, well, Article 3 of the Geneva Convention has some words in it that are vague, humiliating people, et cetera, and where would it end? We don't have to reach that in this case because all authorities agree that torture is not even debatably within that section and one of the more heinous ways that section can be violated. It's not near the margins at all. This court most recently referred to the topic that I just raised in the Saleh decision, where in footnote 13, and I'm referring to Saleh versus Titan Corporation, where in footnote 13, this court specifically noted that that was a torture, a ATS qua torture case, and not an ATS qua war crime case, and that the issue of whether an ATS claim for torture as a war crime could stand was an open question, and it was not alleged in that Saleh case.
There's not a decision, however, that says you can bring an ATS claim against a non-state actor for a violation of the law of nations. Is that safe to say?
Now I believe, Your Honor, you're conflating two issues. There's the question of use of torture as part of an armed conflict, and there's the issue of whether or not the and there's the issue which is raised in our second cause of action, torture done by a government official.
No, but doesn't the Chief Judge's question go to your first claim as well? I mean, we may not have decided that question, but it is a question.
That's what I'm asking you. Is there a case that supports a proposition that you can bring such an action against a non-state actor?
I'm going to answer the question.
I hope so.
I'm going to answer the question a little differently than it's asked, and I hope you don't think I'm avoiding the question. But
I hope I don't think so.
The question. There's a big prelude to that, which is, should we be treating the Palestinian Authority and the PLO as non-state actors?
It's definitely. Are you suggesting there is a Palestinian state?
I'm not suggesting there's a Palestinian state. Absolutely not. But the Palestinian Authority and the PLO are most certainly international actors who are subjects of international law.
All right, assume that they're not a state.
Okay.
Assume that they're not a state.
Correct.
Can you bring this ALS action against
a
non-state?
The Second Circuit said so in Kadzic.
And that's not controlling.
What?
And that's not controlling.
That's not.
Not controlling on us.
It's not controlling on this court. That's
and
correct.
This is the one you're in right now.
But what we have is. Plainly, there's a conflict between the circuits on this point.
And all right, but what's your best authority in this circuit, whether it's dictum or, you know, footnotes, whatever, for the proposition that a non-state actor whom you say is subject to international law. And I was going to ask you, how do we know that? I mean...
Okay. Two questions, Judge.
Yeah.
this court's last decision saying that... saying the contrary of what I'm arguing was a long time ago, admittedly.
But not adversely touched by any later D.C. Circuit
by
case.
This court, but fairly severely criticized by other circuit courts.
Yeah, but we usually leave it to the court in bank to abandon circuit precedents.
That's not in my discretion.
Well, it isn't in our discretion either.
Right.
You know, at some point when a decision has been, where the world has evolved, where other courts have recognized that this
then
approach
might
is
choose to sit en banc to overrule prior precedent.
And if,
but we can't do that as a panel. It doesn't matter how much you think the world has changed. It doesn't matter very much how much we think the world has changed. Circuit law can be changed only by the en banc court.
And I am constrained to wait to see what the panel says before I ask you to sit en banc.
Well,
right?
That's why I was asking you, how do we know that the PLO is subject to international law?
I was about to come to that. Thank you for reminding me. We spent a lot of time looking for parallels in history. It's a pretty unique situation. The PLO started out life as a terrorist organization by all opinions. It achieved some degree of international recognition, more in some quarters than in others, but you know, they did get access to the United Nations. They have embassies around the world, and they have achieved a certain amount of legitimacy, and ultimately entered into a treaty with Israel. The two parties to the Oslo Accords are the PLO and Israel. Israel is unquestionably a state, and the PLO was acting on behalf of a national group, let's say, and the product of this agreement was the Palestinian Authority, which, although it has been roundly decided, has not yet achieved statehood and hasn't been recognized as a state by the United States or by our courts for sovereign immunity purposes, for example.
You're arguing there's a parallelism between its status now and the status of the defendant before the Second Circuit in Kadic? I say, are you arguing that there's a parallel?
A parallel, but it goes much further, because the Palestinian Authority, by all accounts, by everybody's reckoning, is in control of territory, is rendering government services. They are a government. They do have a police department, a police force. They have ambassadors. They have a prime minister and a president. They have elections. And the closest parallel that we found historically is the Free City of Danzig, which was created by the Versailles Treaty as a solution to competing national claims to the city of Danzig, a.k.a. Gdansk, in Poland.
Sosa tells us to be wary of leading the courts into international relations, and I guess I hear you proposing that we, and presumably for it to survive, it would have to meet Supreme Court approval, in effect classify the PLO as, if not a state, the equivalent of a state. I guess to me that sounds like precisely the sort of venture into international relations that Sosa strongly counsels against.
But what Sosa counseled against, the way I read it, is American courts reaching out to create precedents in international law that hadn't been there before.
I read the prudential considerations of Sosa somewhat more broadly. There's a lot of talk about how foreign relations are for the political branches.
But if we accept for the moment the parallel between the Palestinian Authority and the Free City of Danzig, then there is quite a bit of precedent of cases that were brought in the 1920s involving the Free City of Danzig. And I referred to them in the 28J. I believe I referred to a law review article that in my 28J that cites them. But there are numerous decisions of the of international courts ruling on international law issues as to the status of Danzig at that time.
What's the one that's closest to an alien?
I'm sorry?
What's the one that's closest to an ATS claim? What case against involving Danzig?
There were no ATS claims against Danzig. There were no ATS claims to speak of until 1980. But the question is, was Danzig regarded by international law in its day as an actor under international law subject to international law, or was it in those days, the only thing that was considered the subject of international law was a state.
Yeah.
People weren't. That evolved. That came out at Nuremberg. But when people tried to apply international law in court to Danzig, they said, well, we're not a state. And the decision was that, well, you're not a state, but you're close to a state. You're very similar to a state. And you are an actor under international law.
Would that be an accurate way of saying what you want us to do today is to say that non-states, that there is a category of entity between a state and a non-state, which is
close
action, subject to action under the ATS?
Yes. Okay. That would be an accurate way of saying it.
And yeah, if you win on that, you don't have to win on your war crime theory, right? I understand it.
I believe that's correct.
I didn't hear your answer.
I believe that's correct because there are two parallel causes of action, but they.
But if you lose on that, you're
then I need
you're
to win on the war
crime territory. And I guess I've two related problems with that. If this qualifies as a war, don't an awful lot of conflicts around the world qualify as wars? That's partly a question of sort of scope, the size, the scale of the thing. And in addition, again, assuming you've lost on the state actor, you don't have a war between states.
Judge, I'm very happy you asked the question that way because as I was thinking about this case, it struck me how much of the times that question is. We're living in a time right now where our American military is fully engaged. We don't have the capacity to fight another war.
Time's running. You want to get closer to an answer to the question. We are
in both theaters, in Afghanistan and in Iraq. We're not fighting
America.
States.
You
I mean, want
to get closer
states.
To the question that's on the table. Your time's running out.
Oh, I believe I'm answering the question. That is the warfare.
You better hope I believe you're answering it, and I don't think you are.
I believe that is the warfare of the future, and the construct of one state doing war with another state face-to-face is fading into the past as much as the idea of standing with muskets taking turns shooting at each other. The warfare that we have to deal with and the places where war crimes are going to occur are exactly in this type of conflict. That's where our soldiers are experiencing it, and that's where, and that's exactly parallel.
But the act you're suing over, even if there is a war between PA and Israel, which is the first question, even if there is, the act you're suing over was not a part of the conflict, but was something allegedly inflicted upon an individual for acts which had occurred involving intel related to the conflict, whether or not it's a war.
We allege the complaint, Your Honor.
Yeah, suppose that you hunted down somebody after World War II because you're really mad about something they did there and you tortured them a year after World War II, would that be an act of war?
We allege...
A war crime?
No, but we allege in the complaint that the policy of the PA and the PLO of hunting down what they call collaborators and torturing them and making it publicly known that they're tortured is deliberately done as a deterrent as part of their ongoing military efforts. They seek to scare away people from providing information to Israel, and it doesn't matter when the activity occurred. It happened years ago. They didn't know it's not going to happen in the future. They stopped the person from informing, and they scare the bejeebers out of other people with the threat of torture. So we do allege that it is part of an ongoing strategy, and we didn't just make it up. We allege it based on Amnesty International says the same thing, and they're no friends of Israel.
It could be part of an ongoing strategy and not be a part of a war, couldn't it? I mean, there are international strategies that are not wars.
Correct, but we allege that it is part of an, that this was part of the Intifada, which was an absolute, which was an armed conflict.
Second part of Judge Williams' question involves whether you can have war with a non-state actor. Do you, what's your best proposition? I understand you're talking about the asymmetric war that goes on, asymmetric conflict that today is what goes on. But is there anywhere that you have a recognition of the existence of a state of war that does not, a legal recognition of any kind, that does not involve a state actor?
Are you using the word state of war as a technical term, or are we talking about armed conflict?
We're talking about a state of war. Armed conflict is way too broad a term to be equivalent to war.
The reason I'm hesitating is I am not...
What's your best answer to something that's been officially recognized as a war that didn't involve a state actor?
Well, we are right now at war with the Taliban in Afghanistan, and that is not a
That's a conclusion that with this perhaps should be recognized as a state of war. It is not giving me a legal authority. There is a comparison to the Barbary Pirates, but there was never an official recognition that the conflict with the Barbary Pirates was a war.
I didn't think of the Barbary Pirates, but in those days, I believe the state...
Well, those who are taking the position you are, that we are in a war with the Taliban, take the position that this parallels the Barbary Pirates. But then the problem they have is the Barbary Pirates are never recognized officially as a war. I don't mean that there has to be a declaration of war, but something that makes it officially war as opposed to...
Comparing it to Barbary Pirates, though, is probably not a fair comparison because it was so long ago, and it was in a time when we were really still dealing with 18th century notions of international actors.
Get me a lot closer and give me something that actually says that you can have a war with somebody who is not a state.
Well, I would just bring you back to the Second Circuit's decision in Kadzic, which recognized that for ATS purposes, this was a armed conflict, even though there was no recognized state. And I believe the indicator means my time is up.
Yeah, we've talked you over your time. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
We only use those lights to torment counsel. We don't abide by them ourselves.
I'm going to come back.
May it please the court. As this circuit reiterated just last year in Sala versus Titan, torture committed by a state is recognized as a violation of a settled norm of international law, but that cannot be said of torture committed by private actors. Having repeatedly acknowledged that the Palestinian Authority and PLO are not state actors, the Shafis have made two attempts to avoid the Alien Tort Statute's state action requirement. First, they argue that Kadic versus Karadzic's war crimes exception to the state action requirement applies because the PA and the PLO allegedly violated Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. Second, they argue that the Convention Against Torture and the UN General Assembly Resolution Against Torture prohibit torture carried out by public officials even in the absence of state action. As to their first theory, the Shafis have not alleged facts that would bring the PA's or PLO's conduct within Kadic's war crimes exception. Thus, even if this circuit were to adopt...
Why not, since we have to take the complaint as true?
Because Kadic involved claims that were significantly more heinous than those present here. It involved claims of ethnic cleansing.
But the Second Circuit talked about genocide and war crimes.
Correct.
Here the allegation is war crimes.
Yes, and the plaintiff's position is that the torture is a war crime simply because it was allegedly in violation of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. And first, there's a question.
That's not their only argument.
That's how they frame the issue on appeal, is whether torture.
I'm looking at their complaint.
Their complaint doesn't even use the terminology war crime. Their complaint takes the position that any violation of Common Article 3, in this case torture, is a per se a violation of the rules of war and therefore in some broad sense a war crime. But the Alien Tort Statute does not confer jurisdiction over every violation of an international law norm. It confers jurisdiction only over those international law norms that meet SOSA standards. And if one were to treat any violation of the rules
of war.
What
about 18 U.S.C. 2441?
That's a statute that criminalizes war crimes where U.S. actors are involved. It's not, arguably, an extensive exercise of the U.S. court's extraterritorial jurisdiction.
And is it a recognition by Congress that certain types of conduct are war crimes?
I think the better recognition by Congress of what should constitute actionable torture
is that a yes or a no?
I don't believe it speaks to when the U.S. should exercise jurisdiction over acts committed abroad that have no nexus whatsoever to the U.S.
That wasn't my question, was it?
Your question, I'm sorry, Your Honor, your question is whether the war crime statute establishes an international law norm. I don't believe it does. I believe it's a domestic
statute. Whether Congress
statute.
Has recognized that certain types of conduct are war crimes, and you're saying no?
I believe they've treated as actionable under domestic law, which is different from recognizing a norm of international law that is sufficiently narrow, that reaches a sufficiently narrow class of actions that it should be actionable under the Alien Tort Statute.
So under SOSA, it's not enough to have the international conventions. It's not enough to have Common Article 3. It's not enough to have Congress identifying certain conduct as war crimes subject to prosecution. What else is needed under SOSA to have a definite norm?
Well, SOSA does instruct courts to look for guidance to, for example, where Congress has spoken. And I think that the better indicator of what Congress intends to be an appropriate cause of action for claims arising from torture committed abroad is the Torture Victim Protection Act, which imposes liability only as to individuals and only where there's state action. So with respect to the claim of torture, which is what the complaint deals with, what this case presents, for torture, Congress has said these are the kinds of actions we will recognize here in the U.S. And SOSA tells us that the decision of whether to recognize a private right of action alleging violations of international law is best left to the legislative branch in the vast majority of cases. And here Congress
spoke.
Well,
the government's position would be then that not only is the Torture Victim Protection Act the exclusive remedy, but until Congress speaks, the courts are barred from recognizing war crimes committed by non-state actors.
I don't believe that the courts need to wait for Congress to speak, because there could very well be a well-settled norm of international law that meets SOSA's other requirements.
And I was asking you how we identify those if Congress hasn't specifically spoken, and you say we don't have to wait for that.
So one looks to sources of international law to conclude whether it reaches this sort of conduct, but further, it has to be a norm that can be defined with the specificity that was comparable to the 18th century paradigms in existence when the ATS was enacted, and it has to be one that meets a sort of a universal consensus standard, and it has to be one that's not going to open the floodgates of the U.S. courts. And
off floodgates.
Okay. Yeah. All right, use that word.
All right.
Good old floodgator.
Yes. Uh-huh. I read your brief, however, to endorse the 11th Circuit's approach in Emergy. Is that correct?
I certainly endorse the 11th Circuit's conclusion that it cannot be the case that any violation of Common Article 3 gets one out of the state action requirement. That there is this general state action requirement, and it's not enough to just allege a violation of Common Article 3 to then subject private actors to alien tort statute liability. I also agree with the 11th Circuit that SOSA urges courts to consider the prudential aspects of extending alien tort statute jurisdiction and to question whether this truly would be a narrow class of claims that are being recognized. And given the sad number of armed conflicts throughout the world, if any bad thing that happened during an armed conflict became the province of the U.S. courts, that's a very dramatic expansion of the U.S. courts' alien tort statute jurisdiction.
Well, what I was referring to is where in your brief you give us this summary of law.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and you conclude by talking about the 11th Circuit's approach.
Yes.
And I don't see you to reject it. I thought that was the government's position.
The government's position?
The,
you represent.
No.
No, we're, oh, I'm sorry. I think of the government as the U.S. government, the Palestinian Authority. Yes.
You didn't just recognize them as
yeah. a are we a state? yes, our position is consistent with that of the 11th Circuit in America.
All right. And then you argue that the complaint is deficient.
Yes, the complaint does not allege acts that would constitute a war crime. As this court circuit recognized in Sala, Kadich, even as to the war crimes exception, is fairly narrow. It describes a conduct that was universally condemned, this ethnic cleansing campaign during the Bosnian War that was targeted at Bosnian Muslims and Bosnian Croats. And it also involved an actor that was much more state-like than the Palestinian Authority. So the only case that's recognized a small exception to the state action requirement is very distinguishable.
That's a hard argument to make, isn't it?
Pardon?
That's a hard argument to make, isn't it?
Yes. What aspect of it?
I mean, in the sense you say it was more like a state.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me be specific about that. The plaintiffs had alleged in Kadic versus Karadzic that the Serbian Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which was called for some reason Spurska, met the restatement on foreign relations definition of what constitutes a state under an international law. The plaintiffs had alleged that it controlled a defined territory, it controlled populations within its territory, it had declared statehood, it engaged in relations with other states. That's not the PA.
But that's my colloquy with counsel here that you heard.
But the PA does not meet those definitions.
Well, you say that, but I mean they control territory.
They do not control the Gaza Strip. They do not control a lot of territory within the West Bank.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
They control territory. They have international recognition. We're negotiating with them.
Your Honor, they're not recognized internationally as a state. Under the Oslo Accords, the Palestinian Authority is prohibited from engaging
in... But neither was Spurtzva, is all I'm getting at.
But,
let
well,
me ask you, because I want to be very clear about your concern about the complaint. I mean, if you look at the statement of facts in the complaint, what is missing to meet the 11th Circuit test?
The allegations in the allegations in the 11th Circuit complaint were similar in that they alleged that many Israeli civilians were killed in the Second Intifada. This complaint alleges that Palestinians were tortured if they served as confidential informants during the Second Intifada. But the question is there an international law norm that meets SOSA's standards that proscribes this kind of conduct? Yes, it's morally abhorrent. Yes, it should be subject to domestic law. But there's a distinction between issues that are of the several concern of the states and those that are of mutual concern. So, for example, all nations might prohibit bank robbery, but that doesn't make it a question that's been deemed of mutual concern of all the countries such that when this action occurs,
it is universally condemned. How can we find that out? And you say we don't have to wait for Congress. We have these declarations. We have the post-World War II conventions. I'm just trying to define it, and I didn't think the 11th Circuit had a problem as to that.
The recent Second Circuit decision, Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum, actually engages in that exercise with respect to whether the law imposes liability on corporations. And it's a very exhaustive decision because it looks at the sources of international law, conventions, decisions of tribunals, the enabling statutes for the tribunals, looks at sort of whether there's a pattern of practice, looks at what international jurist says. That's the exercise one goes through.
What's the strongest argument here? Is it what Judge Williams was discussing with you, that this is trenching on international relations, or it's that the complaint doesn't meet the 11th Circuit requirements?
I think our strongest argument is that the plaintiffs have alleged that the PAs and PLO are private actors. They framed the issue as whether private actors are liable, and in this circuit they're not. But even if
We don't know, do we?
I guess there's an open question as to whether where you're alleging a war crime, it applies to private actors. And the plaintiff's only argument is that, well, it's a war crime because it violated Common Article 3. And it's not even clear that Common Article 3 even applies here. Common Article 3 applies only when the conduct occurs in the territory of a high contracting party, which the West Bank does not meet that definition. And moreover, the Fourth Geneva Convention, which would be the convention that would apply here because it relates to the protection of civilians in a time of war, protects only those who at a given moment and in any manner find themselves in a case of conflict or occupation in the hands of a party to the conflict or occupying power of which they are not nationals. This isn't Israeli on Palestinian violence or Palestinian on Israeli violence. It's Palestinian on Palestinian violence. And it's not arguably within the territory that's covered by Common Article 3 in the Geneva Convention. So it's not even clear that this framework even applies here. But even assuming for the sake of argument it does, it simply cannot be enough to avoid the state action argument to argue that something bad happened in an armed conflict. And I don't mean to diminish torture. It's horrific. I don't mean to just, I mean to include when I say something bad, really, really horrible things. But it's not enough to allege that in the course of an armed conflict, a civilian was violently treated.
I mean, extend U.S. the alien tort statute didn't suggest these things had to be horrendous. Talking about passage of ambassadors, nothing horrendous there.
Well, I think that's in terms of the modern jurisprudence on alien tort statute, as Sosa describes it, it's intended to reach a narrow class of actions. If you think about it, when the ATS was enacted, there wasn't the sort of volume of international tort litigation.
But even under appellant's theory, it would have to be torture to become actionable under his war crimes theory for the alien tort statute.
Yes, right? Correct.
And torture has to be fairly horrendous to meet any of the various definitions of torture, right?
Yes. But in this circuit, it's only state-sponsored torture that's actionable. And I'd also just like to briefly address this argument that plaintiffs make that even if we can't...
Very briefly, we're going to use the last 4 minutes.
That's fine.
So go ahead and be very brief, but finish up your statement.
Just the notion that even if the state action requirement doesn't apply, there's some norm that prohibits torture by public officials, but the sources that the Shafi cite for this norm are the very sources that are used to identify the state action requirement. It's just another formulation of the state action requirement.
Well, I said we were going to torment you with them, but then I want to ask you something. And of course, my other colleagues may have other questions. Plaintiffs drew a very careful and well-drawn complaint describing the facts. Do those facts describe an act that occurred within a war?
They describe acts that occurred during an armed conflict. No one has declared or described the Second Intifada as a war for international law purposes. I mean, this is the problem with armed conflict. It applies to
many things. That's the question I have there, yeah. And I hope, did I cut off you, Judge Rogers, or were you through?
No, I just wanted to hear her
I have a question, and I'm not sure if it really fits into this case at all, but...
Yeah.
Sosa talks a good deal about precision.
Yes.
And I guess it is true that, certainly the everything except piracy is pretty precise of the three mm-hmm. examples that it discusses. Piracy seems to me, at least at the edges, to be susceptible of confusion and problems of line drawing.
Right.
And in the common law system, what characteristically happens is that something comes before a court that appears to call for a judicial response, because it is, at least viewed in hindsight, egregious.
Right.
But there isn't a very precise definition of just what this cause of action is. Right. And then through endless litigation, a certain amount of precision is attained. Now, Sosa seemed to contemplate this sort of characterization of something as precise or not precise occurring at the outset. So it's not clear to me how you make that work.
Well, to me, this case is more easily resolved than others might be, because Congress has actually spoken. As Sosa said, this is not an area where Congress has been silent. This is an area where Congress described a cause of action that's available for torture committed abroad, and it imposed certain requirements.
Oh, you're going to the right. Preemption.
Well, one doesn't even need to go as far as preemption, but one would expect at least that the Alien Tort Statute would be construed consistently with...
Well, it's consistent to have one statute cover one set of cases and another statute cover another set of cases. That's consistent.
But then you end up with this improbable situation where U.S. nationals who are tortured abroad must meet the requirements that it be the result of state action and that they can impose liability only against individuals, and yet if it's an alien that's tortured abroad, they don't need to plead the Torture Victim Protection Act. They can just argue, oh, it's really a much broader cause of action. But I'm not sure that answered your question, actually.
Yeah. Okay, unless my colleagues have further questions. Seeing none, thank you, counsel. We'll give appellant back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue about the preemption was going to be heard next week on Tuesday, when Ms. Ferguson and I will be back here to argue that before your colleagues in another case. one of the bench asked a question about emergi that I was going to point out myself. We do meet the although we disagree with emergi, when another case that Ms. Ferguson and I had together. We disagree with and think it's wrongly decided, and the 11th Circuit, we believe, made a huge blunder by conflating Article 5 of the Geneva Convention, which deals with crimes against humanity, with Article 3 dealing with war crimes. Article 5 requires a pattern of similar acts. Article 3 doesn't. But regardless, we allege a pattern in this case. So even if emergi is correctly decided, we satisfy it, although we disagree with emergi. Emergi was also extremely narrow. By its own terms, the court said, quote, "We emphasize the limited nature of this holding. We hold today only that a single murder committed by private actors in the course of an ongoing armed conflict, as conceded by defense counsel, cannot confer subject matter jurisdiction." The court went on to say that the emergis have not claimed torture nor of any other distinct war crimes. So emergi on its own face, just on the facial reading of the decision, is not it does not contradict our claims here. The Kiobel case that just came down from the Second Circuit, number one, the Palestinian Authority, whatever it is, one thing it's not a corporation. Kiobel case was dealing with business corporations like oil companies that go drilling for oil and get involved in an entirely different species of problems than what is alleged with the Palestinian Authority. It has no certificate of incorporation. It's a creature of a treaty. It's not a corporation. So to compare it is not right. The most I can say in the shortest words on Kiobel is that the concurring judge Laval in the Kiobel decision, who wrote a extremely lengthy concurring opinion, is we would argue he was right, He found that the majority's reasoning was wrong, but he concurred in the result for a different reason. But he very, very soundly refutes, I believe, the majority's opinion. If the majority's opinion in Kiobel were correct, that would mean that victims of World War II, for example, could not sue Hitler's estate. Why? Because there's no estate has ever been prosecuted in an international tribunal.
Well, it would not mean that at all. It would mean they couldn't sue in this particular jurisdiction under that particular law. If there were a court open in Germany, then this would have no effect on that at all. You're not talking about the problem. You like to talk of conflation. You're conflating the existence of a right with the jurisdiction to pass upon that. We have held rather specifically that the victims of the Japanese atrocities could not sue in this court. I mean, we have the Ju case is directly on point as to what you're saying there, that the victims of the Japanese atrocities could not sue here. We never said they might not have a right under some other body of law in some other place. Saying the United States courts can't solve a problem doesn't mean that there isn't somebody else in the world who should be dealing with that problem. The problem you have is you're bringing a problem to us that isn't evidently ours. You have to make it ours, and to say, well, if you say you can't do it, then the victims of the World War II atrocities couldn't sue the estate of Hitler, you're jumping off a different track. You're not conflating. You're just completely stirring the pot there.
Well, I'm just trying to bring it as an example.
Maybe they couldn't sue in this court.
But, you know, they could sue. Let's say it was Adolf Eichmann was still alive after the war. They could have sued him.
Very possible.
And then
they could have sued
the minute he died.
Very possible they could have sued him.
But now the minute he died, he would no longer be alive. He would be in a state. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, different countries, different legal systems have different attitudes to what happens to claims when somebody
dies. United States can't solve all those problems.
But
these courts, we are courts of limited jurisdiction.
But to continue the case against his estate, once an estate is established for him in whatever jurisdiction he died in,
it's not even an issue before us.
So. Right, but it's hardly an
agreement. Counsel, don't die in that ditch. Pick another one.
Okay.
Your time is
I just wanted to point out.
Unless my colleagues want to torment you some more, you won't get to point that out.
I just wanted to point out two quick things.
Counselor, your time is up. You don't seem to be hearing me. Do my colleagues have further questions? Okay, thank you. Your time is up,